Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And I feel like I'm celebrating with you today after 2 days under podium arrest. And now I've everything in place and I can walk around and travel. That's good. So, happy 4th of July to you. Strange thing for a British person to say to you guys, but never be an actor. Christmas, for example, is celebrated everywhere. Halloween, that's a strange one, but that's celebrated in many countries too. The only two holidays that are distinctly American are obviously the 4th of July, but for obvious reasons, that's signature to this country, and essentially Thanksgiving, which is really only celebrated here and in the neighboring Canada. And the wonderful thing that I find from an American perspective of the holidays of July, 4th, and Thanksgiving is that they contradict each other. Thanksgiving celebrates the survival of the English settlers. And then you just go around a few months and you celebrate losing that. And without a hitch, you just slide in gently into November and it's like, the English have survived.
Some Bible study.
This is good. A class on James, I love these thoughts. I'm very excited about sharing them with you, and I hope you'll be excited with me about enjoying these thoughts and the beautiful pictures that God has encased in His Word for us. The nature of the distance between Jacob and God, self-dependence, the idea that he was a man who had a lot of resources at his disposal, and as a result, was looking primarily to trust in those resources before he was looking to trust in his God. Very hard for certainly me and probably any of you very hard for us to condemn that kind of man, because this is an intrinsically first world problem. We have, by the grace of Almighty God, many apparent resources at our disposal. Apparent resources of financial support, apparent resources of education, all sorts of opportunities and connections. And so it's actually quite hard for us sometimes to remember that we need to trust in our God after some technological issues I'm reminded of it on a daily basis. But we really need to trust in our God more than anything else. How am I going to trust that God will take care of me? And perhaps even more personally, at what level does God expect me, or can I expect me, to provide for myself? These are the basic issues that underline the text. Let's jump in quite literally at the point of the action. And as we meet Jacob this morning, he is wrestling with an angel. And it's Hosea that makes it clear that that's not just a man, but an angel with whom he's wrestling. The angel says this after a night-long wrestling match: your name will be no longer Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. And that thought is repeated later in the prophets. Jacob struggled with the angel and overcame him. He wept and begged for his favor. Okay. This is actually a very interesting scene. Why is it an interesting scene? The Bible makes clear that Jacob overcame the angel, a surprising statement in itself. I suppose we could conjecture that maybe there are angels with limited strength or whatsoever. But there's also verse 25 there, if you have it open in front of you, you can check it, but or trust me, you'll remember when the angel just decided this wrestling match has gone on long enough and just touches his head. And part of the head comes out of joint or something shrivels. I'm not sure of the medical situation. It doesn't matter. By the way, with a single touch, the hip joint is shriveled and debilitated. And so clearly the implication is the angel could have just touched his heart, and his heart might have shriveled and debilitated, in which case he'd be dead. So clearly, the angel was stronger than Jacob. Yet equally clearly, the Bible apparently contradicts that and itself by saying Jacob overcame the angel. Interesting. Whenever we get these apparent contradictions, flags go up in my mind to say, there's something interesting going on here. This is exciting. Let's explore. Well, first off, let's do that by just backing up and then approaching this wrestling match with the full context of the backstory of Jacob. Esau became a skillful hunter, that's his twin brother, of course, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, staying among the tents. Now, the translators may have been a little unfair to Jacob there, because quiet is quite a poor translation of that word. Here are the other renderings of that same Hebrew word, perfect, undefiled, upright. So it's perhaps fair to say that verse is really saying he was a man of integrity. And you think, really? On all the stories that I know? And perhaps that's the essence of the matter. Jacob is a man of integrity. Yet, when under a stress or pressure situation, perhaps that integrity is the first thing that he's prepared to concede in order to achieve the goal that he has in mind. Perhaps that's the nature of the man that we're going to meet. Let's start right at the beginning. At his birth, after Esau's birth, his brother Jacob came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Yaakov, or Jacob. The idea being to grasp the heel. And that has a metaphoric meaning as well as a literal one. It's really to trip someone up, to deceive or to take advantage of. There's a corollary in rugby called the tap tackle, which is the idea that you try to tackle a man and bring him down, but in some cases, he's gone completely past you, and you just can't hit him. The last gasp count you've got is to just smack the side of his foot so that his foot goes behind his other calf, and he falls over, tripped by his own momentum, effectively. They call the tap tackle, and that's really the idea of grasping the heel and thereby tripping up one's opponent. Nevertheless, God had declared that Jacob, the younger, would rule over the elder. And he says by prophecy, two nations are in your womb, and two people from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. And if you want to talk to Bradley Bennett,
that's also an available option at this stage. That's good.
To what extent, therefore, is Jacob allowed to facilitate this end? To what extent is Jacob allowed to achieve and grasp for himself what he knows that God has provided? And what is this promise for anyway? Why should it be that the elder should serve the younger? Just for the sake of contradicting local culture? It's actually part of a much bigger pattern that we don't have time to spend on in exploring in detail. But I will mention just very briefly that it's a pattern throughout Scripture that the younger brother takes precedence over the elder. If you can think of any pair of brothers in the Scriptures, you will find that the younger supersedes the elder. Why? Because that's the pattern of God. First the natural, then the spiritual. You can see it in other cases. You can see it in the kings of Israel between Saul and David. You can see it in the Testaments to some extent. The Old Covenant and the New Covenant. The Old and New Testament. And most importantly of all, you can see it in yourself. You have been born. I have been born 42 years ago. But I have also been baptized. That is to say, I have been born again some 26 years ago. So I am two brothers. I myself walk around as two brothers. There's a 42-year-old version of me, and there's a 26-year-old version of me. There's an older brother who was born naturally, and a younger brother who was born spiritually. And that's the point of this, saying, unless the elder bows down and serves the younger, God's will never be facilitated. That's the bigger pattern that this has always sought to taught to serve. And that's why, in every pattern of brothers throughout the Scriptures, the older is the natural man who succeeds, maybe in natural terms, but the younger is the one who succeeds in spiritual terms and is the one chosen by God. And so we see that Jacob actually takes it upon himself to to seize those things that God has promised him. Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew, I'm famished." Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." Does anyone think it was okay for Jacob to do that, to achieve the end that God had promised? Probably not, indeed not. In fact, what then should Jacob have done? Yeah, if your brother is hungry, feed him. Don't use that as an opportunity to rob from his wallet, which is essentially what Jacob did. And similarly, he deceived his own father so that he could obtain the blessing. "May God give you," says Isaac, "heaven's new and earth's richness, an abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you." Now let's just remind ourselves in concrete terms what the birthright and the blessing are. Part of it's written on the screen, not all of it. The birthright is, in short, a double portion of the inheritance. Catch. It also has some priestly duties that are associated with it. But that's a concrete realization of the birthright. Two-thirds of the inheritance between two brothers. What was the blessing? The blessing was, it says, an abundance of grain and new wine. And that may seem trivial or materialistic. It is not, of course, when you're living in a country and in a culture and an environment where you're not guaranteed where your next meal is coming from. So that's a very reassuring promise to have. "You won't go hungry," says God to Jacob. That's what the blessing contains. And also social standing. The sons of your mother, in other words, your brothers, your peers, may they bow down to you. So that's what we're talking about in tangible terms. Double portion of inheritance, abundance of grain and wine, social standing above your peers. Nevertheless, what were the consequences of Jacob's wrestling this in the way that he did? What were the consequences that came out of this mechanism of achieving what God had promised? Alienation. That's a very gentle and beautifully British understated term. I love it. I would say it this way, but I agree with you. He made his brother homicidally angry, right? That's what happened. It was pretty severe. And in the consequence of the blessing, it's likely, I don't think we can prove this absolutely, that he never saw his mother again. Because of his homicidally angry brother, he had to leave the area, and by the time he's reunited with them, Rachel, his mother, Rebecca, his mother has died. So, should he have taken things the way that he should? There's plenty of examples in Scripture that said that he shouldn't. For example, it was God's will for David to be king in place of Saul. And David had opportunities presented on a silver plate, so it seems, to actually literally kill Saul and take for himself the kingship. "Today," says Abishai, "God has delivered your enemy, that Saul, into your hands." But David said, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him." Is that an important verse? Yes. Why? Because the entire concept of God helps those who help themselves is completely dismantled by such testimony. And also by the behavior, of course, of the Lord Jesus Christ. It was God's will for Jesus to reign over all the kingdoms of the world. And he had an opportunity to make that a reality when shortly after receiving the Holy Spirit without measure. And he said, very frankly, "Absolutely not. Just because I have the ability and the opportunity, and I know that in the end it is God's will, it is not correct for me to grab at some shortcut that does not fulfill the will of God." And of course, the bigger picture in the background is just the ultimate case of Eden. Ultimately, of course, God wants humans to become godly. He wants us to be like God. So all Eve did was take a shortcut. The shortcut is not appropriate. We cannot say that the end justifies the means. I know this is the end. I'll do something a little bit dodgy to get there. It'll be okay. Because the end is God's will. It's God's will for me to be king in place of Saul. It's God's will for me to reign over the kingdoms of men. It's God's will for me to be like God. But under no circumstances does that justify departing from God's instructions in order to achieve that end just because we see an opportunity to grab it for ourselves. And the wrestling doesn't stop there. He was insistent on having Rachel as his wife. Even when Leah was provided by his admittedly equally deceptive uncle, he was determined to press on and get Rachel. Why? Because she was the pretty one. I want the pretty wife. Think about this. Let me ask you a question. How many years did he work for Leah?
Seven.
No. Try again. 14. No. Try again. Yeah. Zero. Remember that? He didn't work a day for Leah. He never wanted her. That's not just a trick question. That actually has very powerful emotional impact. Think about how that would have affected Leah. Jacob worked 7 years for Rachel. But then he got there. Boom. That's not what I want. So then he worked another 7 years for Rachel and got Rachel at the beginning of that period. And then worked a further 6 years for what? Should Jacob have pursued Rachel? This is a bit of a valid question. After all, he fell in love with Rachel, to be fair to him. He was always interested in Rachel. He was undivided in his purpose, and his uncle deceived him. Should Jacob have persisted in the name of love for Rachel? Does anyone see a positive to that? No. And I don't think there is a positive to that. We'll explore more reasons of that later. But again, first of all, here's a command from the law. And admittedly, the law is chronologically downstream from where we are with Jacob, but nonetheless, God's principles are constant through time. Do not take your wife's sister as a rival wife, for obvious reasons in terms of the disharmony and unhappiness that will automatically be introduced into that family. How must Leah feel? Just spare a thought for Leah as she stands there in the fields one day saying, "Oh yeah, there's my younger pretty sister. My husband worked 14 years for her. My goodness, my husband is such a hard worker. He even worked 6 years for these sheep and these goats. But not one day would he work for me. That is how wanted I am." And it's this type of woman, a widow, effectively in her own marriage, whom God hears. And the provision of Jesus of Nazareth, the chosen Messiah, of course, comes through the womb of Leah, the wife that by whatever mechanism God had operated to give to Jacob, and not through the womb of Rachel, the younger, prettier wife. And the wrestling goes on. And he's wrestling now with his uncle to get the most flocks and herds, and the most healthy, and the strongest, and the biggest. And God is blessing it. So he goes to this, some sort of pseudo-scientific jiggery pucker that I don't understand at all. All these plants, I have no clue what that's like. But somehow it works. And he gets the stronger animals, and his uncle is left with the weaker flock. What were the consequences of these wrestlings? Suggestions. What was the consequence of Jacob pursuing Rachel and pursuing the stronger flocks in the manner that he did? Absolutely. Leah is unloved. His wives, two sisters, are now competing with each other. You can see they compete until the end of their lives, or the end of Rachel's life, who died first. And even his uncle and his cousins are angry, and they alienate him. They cut him off and hence Mizpah. These are the consequences of wrestling Israel. He gets sort of what God has promised him, but because he goes about it the way that he does, he has all these additional consequences that need not have come. And it's that point, with that backdrop, that we return to where we started, and we see Jacob wrestling the angel. "Your name will no longer be Jacob," he said, "but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." And already I think we can start to interpret the tone or the theme of what's happening here. Here's perhaps the most important question I might put to you today. What does Jacob wrestling with the angel reveal about his opinion of God? Any suggestions?
He knows better.
Perhaps a little he knows better than God. Yes, I see that. But I see something even darker. Why can't he let the angel go? He wants the blessing. I agree, absolutely. He wants the blessing of Joseph. He doesn't trust God. That's the point. He's like, if I let this angel go, there's no way God will ever bless me. But I found one of his angels. So I'm going to wrestle with him and somehow get that blessing out of his back pocket. Because for sure I'll never get it any other way. Think of a corollary as a parent. Imagine you have a young child, something you won't have to imagine, of course. Imagine you have a young child, just a young son maybe, and who's clinging to your leg at mealtime, begging, "Mommy, you panic. Mommy, mommy, please feed me, please feed me." You'd be a bit embarrassed at the lunch line when you thought, "I usually feed you, right? I don't want to feed you. This is not good, but I feed you. It's fine." And surely that's how God must feel. This angel is actually being mugged. Jacob's opinion of God is that God is so mean and would never hand out a blessing for free, that if you could happen to spot an angel wandering by, rugby tackle him to the ground and beat on him until he gives you a blessing. What opinion is that of God? And that must be the opinion that Jacob holds in order to go through this bizarre conduct. He can't trust God that he's a kind and loving father and the blessings will come. He's convinced he has to fight for them. The answer says, well, hang on a minute. Doesn't Hosea, we hear this verse earlier, doesn't Hosea praise Jacob's wrestling? He struggled with the angel and overcame him. He wept and begged for his favor. And that verse alone suggests it's said in a complimentary and praiseworthy sense. The answer is no. Let's just expand that quote by a couple of verses either side, and we can see clearly that this comment is actually an indictment of Jacob. God will punish Jacob according to his ways and repay him according to his deeds. What did he do wrong? Why, even in the womb, he was grasping his brother's heel. As a man, he struggled with God. He struggled with the angel and overcame him. He wept and begged for his favor. But he must instead grow closer to his God. So when you see that full quote, you can see that the comment of wrestling with the angel is part of the indictment against it. And I point that out because sometimes you'll see that verse 4 quoted as Jacob doing something good. But when you read verses 2 to 6, and that's important to take the context, you can see this is not the case. That's part of his indictment that the prophet is bringing against it. And by then, of course, he's talking about Israel the nation. But the context is the same. What was the consequence? What was the only thing? He got the blessing, agreed. But if God was a kind God, he would have got that anyway. What was the only consequence we can directly link to him wrestling with the angel? Yeah, he wasn't able to walk properly again. Okay. So what then do I see in this actual wrestling match itself? How then do I view it? The way I view it, I see God, i.e. the angel, God is essentially restraining Jacob, who's having a tantrum. Okay? Let's think about the common corollary. You know, when you get to the age of about 2 years old, that's when you really come into your own as having the ability to throw a really master tantrum, right? All four limbs get going at the same time with complete spastic ambition, right? And you eject fluids from every available orifice and just go for it, right? And what does a parent do in such circumstances? Well, the physical superiority of the parent over the child is not relevant here. It's obvious the parent can do anything they want. But quite often, if you leave the child unrestrained, then they might actually injure themselves. So quite often, you'll just hold them and just wait out the storm, right? You'll just hold them for a few minutes while they are absolutely mental. And then, when things finally begin to calm down, you'll maybe bring them close and show them love. Or maybe at a distance, depending on the nature and volume of fluids excreted. One has to be sensible about this sort of thing. And so I think that's sort of what we're seeing in the angel and Jacob. Jacob is just furious that he wants this blessing from God, which he's going to receive anyway. So the angel is just holding him. And an hour goes by, and it's like, goodness me, this guy's really going for it. And the angel is certainly, the angel is far superior in strength. But the angel is holding him, and Jacob's still wrestling, and Jacob's still grappling, and he's still arguing with him and fighting. And the angel's thinking, goodness, this is going on. Get along. Have some tea. And this literally goes on all night. And then finally, the sun's coming up, and he's still going. It's unbelievable. And so he ends up in red. You're just not going to yield. Like, you're just not going to quit. So let's just negative. Sorry. And you can have the blessing. That's not the problem here. God is not afraid to bless the children that he loves. Did you learn anything during the night? And Jacob, whose name Israel is, shouted Israel in the tune of USA. Because he's one and he's got the blessing. And the angel said, yeah, okay, fine. Goodbye. And that's sort of how it goes. And so if we actually put down what Jacob has wrestled for and the consequences he's earned in each case, then I think we can see what's going on. Here on this middle column there, this is Jacob's wrestling trophy cabinet. This is all the things that he has earned from his wrestling. And you can see, it is a catalogue of disaster. It's a series of injuries either inflicted simply on his own body or on the family structure that he has and the people that he loves or is supposed to love. Everyone in sight has been damaged by this protocol. You have struggled with God and with men. Oh, look, Jacob, you've got everything you were after. You are a successful, self-made man. How's this wrestling working out for you, Jacob? How's it working out for you and your family? And so I think what God is really saying to Jacob, it's actually an ironic naming when he calls him Israel. I suspect that God has given the deceiver an ironic or deceptive name. You have strength with God. Some say struggle with God or even prince with God. And I think he's trying to invite Jacob to wake up and smell the coffee. That this strength that he thinks he has, that these monster biceps that have earned him everything he was after, that's actually all that's really in it. Is all this disaster for himself and the ones that he loved. But we still have a question to answer. We've kind of danced around the issue. Fine, all of that makes sense. It's self-consistent. But it still says the angel could not overcome him. And I think to myself, well, what does that really mean? And I realize now that you could ask the question this way and it becomes much easier to answer. What is it about Jacob that the angel cannot overcome? Any suggestions? This, and Dwight said stubbornness, and the fact that was up there doesn't... from Dwight's point of view, that's a particularly difficult answer in time, right? His stubbornness. The free will that Jacob has been given has said, I will not bend my will, I know I'm on this path, this is what I will achieve. And the angel and God can reasonably expect, let's just see how long you'll keep that up. And the answer, even to the point of physical wrestling, is all night long and the next day if need be. And that, even the angel can't change. And God has said, I won't change that. You have free will. You really can be so implacable as to resist me. And I will allow myself to be resisted, if that's what you want. I can't or I won't overcome that. You really are master of your own destiny. I won't come into you until and unless you invite me. You can resist me. And this is a massive spiritual principle. And the man Israel has demonstrated that he was so set on his own mission of achieving by his own ends that was the path he was taking. And I believe the angel crippled Jacob physically just to help him begin to realize this. You haven't won this wrestling match. I can kill you in a second. What are you doing? You're just demonstrating your complete lack of trust in a father who actually loves you, wants to feed you, wants to clothe you, wants to provide you good things. But you don't trust that. Which is why you keep grabbing them at your first opportunity to do so, using ungodly means if necessary. It's easy to criticize someone else, isn't it? What about me? Am I equally invincible? Am I equally just hell-bent on getting what I want my way so that I won't listen to the gentle pointers that God puts around me or allow him to achieve things in his own time? Did Israel learn this lesson? think the simplest answer is not that day anyway. I think he will eventually. It's nice to think that he learned the lesson that day, but I think the scriptural evidence is strongly against it. We won't have time to go into these verses specifically because they'll reveal basically more of the same. But as Joseph comes along, that's the symbol I'm using for Joseph over there, that son that he loved so much he gave a coat of many colours. You can see Jacob's self-reliant over-protection of that one son that he loves more than the others. And when that son is killed, or so he thinks, then his transfers that same pattern of behaviour onto essentially his second favourite son, i.e. the only two sons born of Rachel. Remember, the pretty wife that he really loved. And so you see Jacob continuing at the moment. So he hasn't learned his lesson, at least not as we get through these scriptures into Genesis 42. So what happens next? Now God touches Jacob. In fact, he touches the whole land. And if we're following a different storyline thread, Joseph of Egypt, we'll know that this is the drought. This is the drought of which Pharaoh had dreamed in two separate dreams. 7 years of drought, so severe that it stripped the land of Egypt and all the neighboring countries, including Israel, of their natural resources. And as a consequence, more storyline here, but as a consequence, ultimately, Jacob is called to go down to Egypt. And in actual fact, and this is a big point that I didn't realize until very recently, God actually takes away all the things that he promised to give to Jacob. He promised him the birthright. He takes it away. He promised him the blessing. He takes it away. And you might think that's surprising. Surely God is true to his promises. Ultimately, he is. But I think, again, it's that parent situation. The parent wants to give nice toys to the child, but the child insists on snatching them. And it's like, no, don't do it. No, mine, got it. It's like, okay, well, we'll have to put that toy back on the shelf, then, won't we? And when you can learn to play nice, maybe you can have the toy again. Until then, we're going to have to take that off you for your own development. Those of you who are parents will know this firsthand. And in this case, God has taken everything away. Let's make sure that's true. Let's check on that. Of course, there's a drought. So the flocks and herds now have no land on which to graze because there's a drought. So they are doubtless depleted and going down. There's a drought. The abundance of grain and new wine that was promised by God. Is he unfaithful? But he has at least temporarily taken that promise away. Jacob doesn't have an abundance of grain. It says so in the text. He has to send down to Egypt just to get food. The social standing, your own brothers will bow down to you, promises the blessing. Actually, Jacob ends up bowing down to his own son. Not that he knows it's his son at that stage. But the social standing has been taken away as part of the blessing. The birthright, the riches, the inheritance. He's in a barren land, a land so barren that he actually has to transfer himself from being a citizen to being an immigrant who merely has to beg for food. So that's all gone. The pretty wife. Oh yes, the pretty wife. Sorry, she's dead now. She died in childbirth en route to Ephrathah at a tiny little hamlet called Bethlehem. And there's a lot in that too. No time for it. But the pretty wife is gone. And even the favorite son is dead. As far as Jacob knows, anyway. In Jacob's mind, even that is dead. This is everything that he wrestled for. The birthright, the blessing, the standing, the food, the pretty wife, the son he overprotected. It's all gone. And finally, Israel stands before Pharaoh. And on that day when he stands before Pharaoh, he's old, he's lame because of the wrestling match. He's homeless, he doesn't have a land to live in. He's bereaved of the wife that he loved and of the son that he loved. And he's hungry. And he's brought to that pitiful position that he actually has to ask a foreign king, please, may I have something to eat? What a humiliating situation. By the grace of God, not the one to which I've been brought, but through no strength of mine. By the time Jacob stands in front of Pharaoh as an old man, he has nothing left to wrestle with. All these resources that he had, the cunning, the deceptiveness, the big biceps, Israel, that's all gone now. And frankly, and most poignantly of all, he doesn't really have anything to wrestle for. got nothing. Well might he say, few and evil are the days of the years of my life been. Finally, at last, Israel, the man who is strength with God, is weak. This is the point of victory for Israel, even though he doesn't know it. He's not happy in front of Pharaoh, so much as fear. What then does the loving father do with the man who now sees that he is weak, and from whom all the blessings he was promised have been stripped? What does God do? He gives everything back for free, almost immediately, and in a way in which Jacob is able to see that he could not have achieved it at his own hands. He's homeless, and he gets his home back, his social standing. He gets his food back. Joseph also, from the stores that he had brought up, provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food. The livestock that he lost and being depleted. Why? The Egyptians didn't like being shepherds, so the Egyptians brought all their livestock to Joseph, and he gave them food in exchange. So his family, through Joseph at least, is rich, richer probably than they ever were, in horses and sheep and goats and cattle and donkeys. Joseph bought all the land in Egypt for Pharaoh. And so Joseph's family, Jacob included, are now the second richest family in the entire land, second only to Pharaoh himself. And even the son that was dead, God says, oh yes, your beloved son who was dead, why don't you have him back as well? I am a good father. And so Jacob comes to realize that the son he thought was dead is actually alive. How much he would have rejoiced. Israel said to Joseph, now I'm even ready to finish my days because I have seen for myself that you are still alive. And his loving father, for free and for nothing, gives everything back that Jacob had spent his life wrestling for. And God had taken away to show the impermanent permanence of his own efforts. And I say everything. Wait a minute. Something is missing. What was missing? The second wife. And I think that, more than anything, underscores that it was never God's intention that Jacob should press on for this wife that was not meant for him, regardless of how pretty she may have been. God does not restore the second wife. Everything else. Has Israel learned Israel's lesson? And just to clarify, when I say Israel, I don't mean Israel. I mean Israel. So I meant Israel. In other words, let's think about the country, not just the person. Has Israel learned to trust in their loving father? There are massive walls. Look at the height of those concrete walls. Powerful guns, an army, big guns that go bang, and planes that fly, and wrestling and struggling and fighting. Israel is still wrestling. And the reason that these guns exist, and that these tanks exist, and that these fighter aircraft, even a nuclear capability exists, and these tall walls exist, you know why they exist, don't you? Because you can't trust God to keep you in the land. You've got to wrestle for it. We've seen that somewhere before, haven't we? Now, in fairness, it would take an absolutely outrageous amount of faith to dismantle that. But God is God. And if they've really read the book of Genesis, and they've really read about the life story of the man after whom as a nation they are named, they should be able to see both what is and what's coming. But for now, they are still wrestling. Israel wrestles. Let's just run through, by way of a little summary, just the timeline that we've seen so far. There's a reason for doing this, so even though there's a slight key element here, please bear with me with your attention, because it's worth doing, I think. We have seen that Israel wrestled for all those things that he wanted, many of which God had promised. Then we come to a stage by chapter 37 of Genesis, this is a timeline, that Jacob, Israel, believes that his beloved son is actually dead. Realistically, however, he's been sold into slavery in Egypt. The beloved son is actually alive. And as the timeline continues, we see that he's actually second in command to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Pharaoh had Joseph ride in a chariot as his second in command. And in fact, not only is he alive, but he is also working. He is working to store up food that will ultimately feed the family. And not just the family, but actually anyone who comes along, he will provide food. And then we reach the point where God takes everything away to teach Israel his true strength, which is nothing without God. The son is working unrecognized for the family he loves to feed all who come to him. And finally, Israel, standing before Pharaoh, sees his weakness. Sorry, that's not final. So when he sees his weakness and he sees that he's lost everything he wrestled for, God restores his home and everything that he had before, except the extra wife. And Israel finally sees the beloved son, and in the last chapter of the book, Israel bows down and worships the son. Okay? That's what we've seen. Let's do that again. We considered Israel the man. Now let us parallel that with Israel the nation. And what we're going to see, you probably see it coming, and that's fine, let's look through it anyway, is that the story is going to be identical. God is this powerful. You see, the prophets and Jesus only repeated in their prophecy what had already been written in the book of Genesis. The entire history and future of Israel is encoded in the book of Genesis. We only have to read that first book in a way. Israel wrestles, and we've seen that from the wrestling. Israel believes that the beloved son is dead. Jacob? Well, that's interesting, because Israel believes that the beloved son, Jesus of Nazareth, is in fact dead. After all, he wasn't the Messiah, so they say, and he died on the cross quite a long time ago. As it happens, from Genesis, the beloved son is actually alive. Well, that's interesting, because as it happens, the beloved son is actually alive. In fact, not only is the beloved son alive, but he happens to be the second in command in a nearby kingdom. A kingdom that is so nearby it is among you, within you. And he is the second in command of this mighty kingdom. I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God, says Stephen. Stephen saw this by vision and with his own eyes and his own perception. But my point to you is that we can see this too by reading the book of Genesis. The Son is actually working, unrecognized, for the family he loves. In fact, to feed any who will come to him. Whoever comes to me, I will not turn away. I will provide him the bread from heaven. Straight from John chapter 6. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. And that's where we are in the year 2012. So the exciting bit is we can now read on in Genesis and read on a certain future of what's going to happen, what has happened many years ago with Israel the man, and what will happen in the future with Israel the nation. God will take everything away to teach Israel his true strength. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Terrible scenes are to come. And Israel will finally see his weakness. And I wonder how many of them in that day, after these terrible things have happened, will understandably say, "Few and evil have the days or the years of my life been." And then God will restore everything. After Israel has realized that his wrestling was always futile, God will give everything back. Jerusalem will be raised up high. Never again will it be destroyed. Jerusalem will be secure. Except the extra spouse. You see, Israel's had a lot of additional spouses, haven't they? They're supposed to have one husband, Yahweh. But they took up with many other spouses and prostituted themselves. There were complaints about it even back in the Old Testament. Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. And to this day, Judaism, which refuses to recognize the Messiah. Atheism, materialism, all the evils of the Western world, all of those extra spouses, they don't get given back. Rather, all the nations may walk in the name of their gods, but in that day, we will walk in the name of Yahweh, the Lord, our God, forever and ever. And we've seen that before. And Israel finally sees the Beloved Son. They will look on me, says the Beloved Son, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him. And then now, the last chapter of the book takes on a newer and profound beauty. As the personal man story, it was not a particularly climactic ending that Israel ended up bowing down to his own son. But in the context of the nation, how beautiful it is that Israel, finally seeing the beloved son they always thought was dead, will actually bow down to that beloved son. That at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And now I see a much more powerful ending to that first book of the Bible. It was written all along in the book of Genesis. And so when that beloved son is actually meeting with the Pharisees, and they are saying to him, "Who are you anyway? We don't know who you are. You're some sort of carpenter's son, aren't you?" In reality, we actually follow Moses. Well might he have said, "If you believed Moses, you would believe me, because he wrote about me." Not Isaiah, although Isaiah wrote about him. Not David, although David wrote about him. But Moses. Moses, the one in whom you place your trust, he wrote about me. And I believe that this is primarily what Jesus was referencing. There are other references, of course, Exodus 12, the Passover lamb, Exodus 21, the pierced slave, beautiful pictures all. But this is the most clear and explicit talk through of the history and future of the beloved Son of Israel. And I believe that is what Jesus was saying. Just read the book of Genesis with your eyes open, and you will see what is clearly laid out before you. And yet, for all this, God chose Israel. He chose that one who was so insistent and so desperate to survive and depend on himself and his own means. God knows to expect the struggle of reliance, self-reliance, and in his selection, therefore, of Jacob as a man to be father of his people, he shows that he is willing to work with that weakness. He's willing to work with us who similarly suffer. What then can I learn from Israel's experience? I shouldn't wrestle with my brothers. It only causes damage in the family. If I'm reading the book of Genesis as the Israel should be, then that is what I see unmistakably. There are many ways to express this. I've just chosen this particular quote. It has no particular meaning. I don't know why I chose this one, but I thought it summarized it rather nicely. People are often unreasonable and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are honest, people may cheat you. Be honest anyway. The good you do today may be forgotten tomorrow. Do well anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give your best anyway. For you see, in the end, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. I think those are words that well summarize the scriptural principles that we've seen in the book of Genesis. And finally, perhaps, how else can I learn from Israel's experiences in my own efforts to grow closer to God? Don't grab at God's blessings. Yes, he may have promised you things and you may see them before you, but that doesn't mean that you are justified in using any means possible to obtain them. Don't grab at the fruit. Yes, he wants you to be like God eventually. Don't grab at the shortcuts. At the end of the day, why would I grab? What strength do I really have with God? Am I Israel? Am I biceps anything before the Father? What power do I have with my Father? I have as much power as is shown here as this son has with his father. And yet, ironically, how much power does that son have with his father? Quite a lot. But only because of the Father's love. Without the Father's love, should these two creatures become enemies, then the Son has no power at all. He is robbed of any ability to even survive. He is dependent entirely on the Father showing such intense love for him that the Son thereby has power with the Father. Because that's what Jesus told us. He didn't say, "Fear not, little flock, your biceps are big enough to wrestle the kingdom out of God's hands, but you don't really want to give it to you. Please mug the nearest angel," right? He did not say that. Rather, he said, "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." No wrestling required.